5 seconds to submergence. Submergence deep into the absurd.
All right, we've got Kenny Robey on the podcast today. He is a musician, a very talented musician that has a lot to say in his songs and in our conversation. He is very intelligent, wise, kind, and just all around a great human being and an artist. As a housekeeping item, I just wanted to mention that if you're a new listener to the podcast and you want to dive deeper into the absurd, then just check out the link in the description to my personal profile on Spotify, where I have a ton of playlists of the podcast with different subjects such as psychology or Nietzsche, the will to power, things like these on my Spotify account. If you just go to playlists, just search for my emblem, the Sisyphus guy pushing the yin and yang up a hill. So without further ado, here's Kenny Robey, everybody.
I could drink just a little, but a little leads to more than I'm down at the store and knocking on your door for some cold rain. I wish I could take a little taste, babe, to put me in just the right place, babe, but a little bit of taste puts a look on my face, and I'm on a train that leads me to cocaine. Love, babe, that I love you too much, then I'm cussing your charge. And ain't that a little like cocaine? I'm gonna make my whole life a new mess now. Dancing with the lady in a white dress now. Then I'm stuck on the rail with a shovel and a pail. I'm on the working train in the St. James. To the banks of the sea, let me jump in the water, can't swim any harder, dirty water, Jimmy's daughter and cocaine, dirty water, Jimmy's daughter and cocaine, dirty water, Jimmy's daughter and cocaine.
All right, that is All Trains Lead to Cocaine by Kenny Robey, the latest guest on the podcast. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So how'd you come up with that song?
I don't really know. I was just driving around one day. It just sort of came to me. And they just sort of mature and incubate a little bit. And it was actually probably pretty quick, that one, as far as the basic idea for it. I mean, obviously it's about probably 20 different old blues melodies from the early 19 to mid 1900s. Yeah, I don't really know. It just came to me, you know. I always felt it was sort of that, it's kind of that dark John Lee Hooker kind of vibe to it, of his first recordings, like his 50s stuff. first Columbia stuff, I think it was.
Yeah, I wanted to play it as an introduction because it's definitely my favorite one of your songs, at least so far of what I've listened to. And I think it really, I really love the sound of it, but it's also the lyrics kind of stick with me in a sense where I've struggled with addiction in the past. So when I hear things like, it's like, oh, I wish I could drink just a little, but a little bit of drink leads to one thing after another. Next thing I'm doing cocaine. I mean, I've never been addicted to cocaine, it's kind of like with all addictions, they work that way because we have these routines and habits that we put ourselves through. And then if we do, you know, if we do one thing, say like, even if we do like part of our own ritual, that involves the thing that we're addicted to, we'll end up doing the thing we're addicted to.
Sure.
And that's why it stood out to me. I don't know if you had any input as far as addiction goes, but.
Oh yeah. How much time do you have? it's, you know, if I get going on it, yeah, I could sort of wax on it for a long time. I mean, I guess the big thing about, like, I guess the thing that stands out, that song, the most as far as, I guess, sort of, I don't know what you would call it, philosophy or whatever, yeah, on addiction, the psychology on it is, you know, that really, let me go back and say there are people that would make the argument, some psychologists, counselors, and researchers that, you know, that we're all addicts.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a matter of what. And then some of us, like, it's on a spectrum, like other mental health disorders, to where it's just a matter of to what degree, you know. But if everybody really, really looked at it in themselves in the right way, with the right guide to looking at it in different ways, and was open to it, they would realize that, that we all have addictions, and that we all, you know, cling to things, and we all strive for things, and then that can be sort of unhealthy. And even things that can, that appear to be, or society marks them as healthy, aren't necessarily healthy either, you know? And so that's the sort of,
or at least when they're overdone,
the defect, or the defect, or to the degree, you know, that things go, it's a matter of, like, if you, trying to figure out how to put this, it's
like, how much does it affect your life? How much is it?
Yeah, how much does it affect you? And, like, which the extremes that you go to for these certain things. And so, like, that's the spectrum thing. Like, what, you know, what, how strong is things, are things in you? And, you know, I can sort of, like, replace any drug or alcohol or exercise or eating unhealthy or obsessing or spirituality or whatever with and become sort of someone who's practicing addictive behaviors to whatever. Any seed can grow with me with the addiction type stuff, because I am, you know, I do have a tendency. I am an addict, you know, I am. And it's just a matter of certain things, like, oh, like, what's my drugs of choice at that time, you know? And so that's, I guess, what this, getting back to, it's a long winded way to sort of say what that song is about, is, you know, that cocaine is like love, is like a drug, is like sex, is like whatever it is, you know, that we can all sort of relate to that, you know.
YZ.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter what it is. So, like, what we work on is our sort of attachment to all of these things, and to be aware of them. And there are certain things that I don't do well in moderation, so I don't do them. I abstain because I don't, like you were saying, I can't practice this beginning of the ritual because I got to finish it out. I have the obsessive, compulsive disorder of I mean, I'm not saying I'm OCD and that's, you know, in that clinical sense, but, you know, that, that it's a disease of obsession and then you have to act on it. You know, you obsess on it, then you have to act on it. And so I guess it is in that way. You know, obviously not a psychologist, but
it's, you're human.
It's still similar. Yeah. It's similar to that, you know, that it's like, oh, if I lock in and start thinking on it, if I get attached to the thoughts of it, and if I sort of make up my mind or my mind's made up, whether you could say I have the control over it or willpower to do anything about it, that I can definitely like lock in and then I have to finish it out. I have to sort of play that whole thing out. And so, you know, we have to sort of replace like the playing it out thing with, you know, people in recovery. A lot of times it's like, you have to, as they say, you have to play the whole tape, you know? So you have to like see what the beginning and the end before you act on things and go, oh yes, I don't see that glass of alcohol. I see the chaos that, you know, it's not a glass of bourbon. It's a glass of chaos. You know, it's a glass of more bourbons and it's more, and then it's destruction and it leads to these things that are destructive in my life. Because I have to abstain because it's like, you know, if I have a, some kind of skin issue or a skin disease or whatever it is that allows me that, that, that tells me that I can't be out in the sun or I'm going to pay the consequences. It's the same thing. In that way to me. Is I just don't have the luxury of being able to go out in the sun like others, metaphorically, so to speak, sort of with alcohol or drugs or certain other things. I don't eat meat, and part of it is political, part of it is, you know, ethical, humanitarian, all those reasons, and then part of it is because I'll eat all of it, and there won't be any for you. You know, if I start like, oh, I'll have some shrimp at the beach, you know, or I'll have a piece of chicken, before you know it, it's like all I want is, and it's McDonald's cheeseburgers that I don't have, you know. And it's funny, I think that, you know, I used to think that was like a willpower thing, but I don't know if it necessarily is. I think it's just sort of how I'm wired, you know.
And yeah, I mean, so sometimes I think there's like certain grooves in our mind, like certain habitual grooves that are carved just so deep that if you get like near that hole, you know, you're going to get drawn in.
Absolutely. You know, I definitely see that. I see these patterns and I see it in myself and I see it in others. And I see it, there's that whole thing about people talk about being like grateful recovering alcoholic or grateful recovering addict or grateful, whatever recovering people, whatever that is, you know, it doesn't matter what sort of group they're in, or how they associate that I think there's something to it because if, you know, I hate the things that I've done in my life that I do have regrets. And ways that I've acted on my addictions and my impulses and my obsessions that have harmed other people and myself. Yeah. But at the same time, it led me to where I am. And then I have these tools now and I'm able to help myself and others are able to help me and vice versa. And, you know, without the sort of being an alcoholic, you know, or someone, or an addict or whatever, whatever that is, then it's sort of, I wouldn't have these opportunities and I wouldn't have this awareness because I think a lot of people don't, that they are, it's not my position or job to call them this or say you're this or that. but I do feel there's a lot of people walking around that don't even know it, you know, that they have these diseases and mental health disorders and they have no idea, you know, that they for whatever it is, whether it's gambling or whether it's food or whether it's just control over their kids or their parents or, you know, control over things around them, these obsessions and, you know, struggle for control that that would be helped by, you know, some of these taking these some of these other roads that they're not that they may never get to take, you know.
So do you find yourself kind of redirecting that addictive energy into healthy things such as music, your passion for music?
I think I don't know if I redirect it, but because I have that kind of mind, then I can really get obsessed with things and lock into it. You know, I think it's more like, well, if I'm going to obsess on something, it might as well be something somewhat healthy.
No, I think that's why in many ways, an addictive personality can be a strong trait. It could be, a benefit if, say, you're using it in a way where you can, like, oh, well, I'll just keep playing songs and throw it on Spotify and make all trains lead to cocaine and have people listen to that awesome song, you know? And I think that can be a powerful thing. But also, at the same time, even so, you can still get lost in those obsessions still, and it can negatively affect your life.
Yeah, and you're and you know, there's also a thing where people talk about, well, kind of everything is relationship. Everything is relationships. Yeah. And you know, it can have an extreme effect on your relationships. I mean, I've done just as much damage in my life without drugs and alcohol in me. Yeah. And I've done just as much harm sort of running over people with my obsessiveness and my drive. Sure, there are a lot of pro athletes, you know, maybe Michael Jordan would be one of them, people like that, that, you know, that probably have run off a lot of friends with their and teammates and people in them because of their sort of obsessive nature or addictive nature, whatever you want to call it, their drive. Can really run people over, that same drive. You can really put your life out of balance. And I think that's the biggest danger. And the biggest thing as I get older that I have realized is when my life's out of balance and when that needs work, and when I'm not sort of taking that middle path. And so to try to be okay with, you know, everything, and sort of just take things as they come. And that's like why that's a huge thing in the recovery community, is to let go and go with the flow. And you know, whether it's you're looking at Stoicism or Buddhism or, you know, Taoist philosophy or Christianity or whatever that it's, or recovery or a lot of self-help stuff, which is a lot of it is recovery based now. And a lot of it's Buddhism based, and a lot of it's, you know, a lot of that stuff. But, I think that a lot of that is about sort of acceptance and letting go, and then looking at what you have power over and looking at what you really have control over and what you don't have control over, because that leads to some pretty unhealthy behaviors, you know, trying to control situations, yourself, other people, like that really, really can lead you down some really bad roads. It can really mess up relationships, you know, as not letting other people be where they are, letting yourself be where you are too. I mean, you can have a terrible relationship with yourself as well, obviously. And to learn to sort of take it easy and be a little kinder to yourself and other people is huge.
I mean, do you think, so you're saying that that relationships is everything, right? Your relationship with other people, your relationship with yourself. Do you think that addiction is also in and of itself a relationship, your relationship to a habit or a substance or an obsession, and that's kind of becoming toxic?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that is, it's my relationship with people and places and things and all that's wrapped up in sort of that culture and that, you know, a lot of it really stems, though, from our relationships with ourselves, you know, and to the world around us. I think it starts very, very young. I mean, disclaimer once again, I'm just a human and not a psychologist or a researcher, but it starts really young, and then we reinforce it with our behaviors and our habits and our practices. And what we hone our skills at, whether that's being controlling of ourselves or others, or trying to hold life too tightly or whatever, we sort of hone those skills and we those practices, and they're hard to break. They build up over years, for sure.
And it's kind of like a diffusion of responsibility. You're like offloading some of your responsibility onto this thing that you're obsessed over that's kind of controlling your life. And I've been in many situations where I've let a substance or a habit or any number of things just like totally control my life or control my schedule. Like, no, I need to, even with going to the gym, like mm-hmm. I have this obsession where I feel like I need to go to the gym like every day or otherwise I'll feel gross or like I'll feel bloated or whatever, but that's not, you know, that's not a good relationship to the gym. It's not even a good relationship to my body or how I feel, you know?
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. For sure.
I wanted to ask you, so you were saying that in overcoming addiction, it was kind of this acceptance. And I wanted to ask if your song New Day, it's one of your most popular songs, if that kind of relates to that concept.
Will you repeat that? I got a little distracted in my own mind and looking at my screen. My apology. I'm just being honest. Yeah, I'd rather.
Your song New Day, it's mm-hmm. it's one of your most popular songs, and I just wanted to know if that song has anything to do with letting go of the past and kind of accepting yourself, or what that song was about.
Absolutely. You know, whatever you'd want to call it, like spiritual, mental, emotional plasticity, you know, like being able to let go of stuff. It's like you have to accept responsibility and be accountable for your actions. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I guess the paradox is that you also have to let go of that as well.
Yeah.
And you have to, I forgot his name, and I think he was the head of like the Insight Meditation Center in California. I think it's in LA. And I was listening to some of his podcasts for a while and talks during the early in the pandemic. And, you know, he talks about like what I touched on earlier about like the being skilled or unskilled, and to sort of give yourself a break, not that it's an excuse, but for your past actions or whatever, you have to go, well, I was unaware, I was unpracticed, I was ignorant, I was unskilled, like all these kind of things, to where you're not beating yourself up over things, because you have no, about the control thing, we have no control over our past actions. And we have to deal with the consequences of them, but we have no control over them. I mean, that is like, we have no control over them, just like we have no control over our future actions. We have controls, I guess, this sort of, you know, the Epictetus thing would be the, you know, that we have control over our intentions, you know, like I intend to go to the gym, but you know, anything could happen that would keep me from going to the gym. The power can go out. Yeah. I could trip and hurt myself. Somebody could get, I could get a phone call that sort of influences me not being able to go. I could blow out a tire, like whatever it is. So like, I think a lot, I was talking to my partner this morning and I was telling her that, you know, it's like, if you really break down, you know, whether it's like that, you're this sort of control that you have over things, or, you know, whether it's like the serenity prayer, like all these different philosophies are basically talking about the same thing to me. And I gather that's, or at least that's what I take from a lot of them. And we don't really like, a lot of things we kind of can pretend we have control over. We can manipulate the sort of conversation with ourselves. So, oh, I do have control whether I go to work. But really, like the intention and the practices that lead up to working towards that thing, you have control over to some degree. But ultimately, you actually, it's a result, you know, being at the gym is a result of a bunch of things coming together, you know? Maybe that's getting a little micro on it, but so I think that sort of gives us, it's not an excuse, but a reality check to sort of give ourselves and other people a break, and to take it easy a little bit on our lives and ourselves, that we just, you know, and we got, I have to be careful because I can swing the other way. Like you're saying, I don't go to the gym, I don't feel well, or I'm eating bad. You know, I can easily, like, all trains lead to cocaine, you know, like this, like I can get on any train and it all leads to this type of behavior. You know, that's almost like, obviously, you know, on the surface, on a basic level, is about alcohol leading to cocaine, but it's really just about any time you get on that train, you're going to get there and eventually. So
it's kind of like you do one, it's kind of a domino effect where you do one thing and then it just leads to a number of other things where you just don't, you're in a place where you just feel like you don't really have control, or like you're on this, like you're on a script, almost like an autopilot.
Yeah, it's very, you know, and it's very cunning and it's very sort of deceptive and you know, I guess insidious or whatever, like it's very deep rooted, like all this kind of stuff, like we're not even aware of most of it. So the things that I am aware of, I have to work on, or I mean, awareness is huge, and then acceptance of this, and then if I accept it, then I can go, okay, this can be worked on. You know, I got here, I can get get away from here. But it can it can be very, very cunning. You know, these things are, that's why, you know, I have conversations with people sometimes and they're pretty unforgiving of like others, of their behaviors. And I think it's because they're not looking at their own and they don't see the the same thing in themselves. Is that, no, I'm not that way because this or that, like whether it's like, you know, blaming someone for their weight, you know, or their drug addiction or like all these kind of things. And it's like, you know, you gotta walk a little lightly with that stuff. Like we don't, you don't know somebody's situation, what their background is and what their body makeup is and what their brain chemistry is. And, you know, it's just, we can have boundaries and doesn't mean you have to be friends with them. You know, if people are unhealthy for you to be around, but you can sort of detach with love, as they say. You know, I can just have a boundary. I truly want the best for you, but you're not good for me to be around, you know?
And that's, you can kind of understand and forgive someone without, say, like being around them, right?
Absolutely. Well, because
to yourself in their shoes, too.
Yeah, and you know, and I have to watch that. And a lot of people, there's a lot of people in recovery groups that have to watch that, or people with mental health issues, or just humans in general have to watch some of this stuff, because I not only, you know, struggle with my addictive tendencies, but I also struggle with sort of codependent issues. You know, so I can easily turn it around and like co-sign somebody behaving that way, and then like want to help them and do more harm. I can love them to death. I can do things that really I can make about me. I can pretend it's about them and helping them, but it's more like my comfort. I was really blown away when I read that, you know, how much codependency is about control. You know, it's about, it's very self-centered, like with the codependent. Yeah. It's because it's about their feelings of like, oh, I don't want you to suffer in this way because it makes me suffer in this way. So let me help you not suffer this way. It's, you know, not an interdependent kind of way, but in a way that's, that it's really about the codependent a lot of times. Like in a way, they're just for, I mean, I wouldn't say guilty. That's not what I mean. They have a part in it as well. With this stuff, you know, it's easy to just blame the addict in your life, you know, but you know, it's my boundaries as well that sort of co-sign and assist in those things, you know.
Could you elaborate on what you mean by codependent?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't have we could look up a textbook definition, but you know, I mean, in the sense of with an addict. Well, in a sense of like, say, with a typical, I think, forgive me, those out there that know more than I do on this, is that it's a, that it's someone who sort of enables the addict, you know, but there's also, or addictive behavior, and there's all kinds of tendencies of a codependent person. And a lot of it is sort of trying to control that other person and think they know what may be best for the other person. And they truly don't want to see the other person suffer. But a lot of times I think the root of it is it's for my sake that I don't want you to suffer, but it's because I'm suffering watching you suffer. You know, it's not like altruistic, yeah. Like I'm doing this for you. Like, and I think a lot of times I could, you know, people get, and myself could get sort of a martyr complex about it, but I have a part in it too. You know, if you ask me for money, it's not your fault. You know, I mean, it's not all your fault. I said yes, you know?
Yeah.
And I continue to do these things for you that help enable you to act in unhealthy ways. And so I have a part in that, you know, and it's so easy to sort of dump that. I think a lot of people on the sort of addict or the whatever that addiction is. It's a little shaky ground I'm on with this because, you know, I'm only qualified to speak of my mind and my experience. Yeah. And even with that, I still change my mind and I have a gray memory and attention issues and I'm limited on my knowledge and I'm limited on my experience and on my practices. But I do think there are lots of addicts that have codependent, you know, somebody said that, you know, that many, if not all, like addicts are is also codependent, but not all codependents are addicts. You know, but I've talked to my therapist about some of this stuff and he's like, yes, it's very, they have a lot of the same traits and the MO is a lot of it is the same. And that's to feel better, to feel more comfortable, to feel okay, to feel at peace, to feel secure, like these things that, you know, that we want to feel, whether it's, we do it through drugs or whether it's, we do it through, I'm going to give my son, you know, too much material goods or swoop in and help him in situations where I should have let him hit his bottom, you know, and I'm not specifically talking about my kids, but just raising kids or parents, you know, because what I do is I make it about me, about how I feel about what he's going through, that I may deny him the experience that he has to go through to learn what he needs to learn. Right. So I deny him that by doing things for him, you know, and it's so easy as a parent in this example, it's so easy as a parent, especially to sort of do that or feel like it's your job when it's not. I think in the society, we sort of promote that. And, I think it has a negative effect, you know, of not letting people sort of take their lumps. And it's really hard because you hate to see the people you love suffer. And you hate to suffer over it as well. And so we go to the, like we were talking earlier, we go to these extremes, like giving someone money that you can't really afford to give them and making them sort of more important than you and their health and their safety and their sanity, like more important than you in a way that's actually harmful to both of you. I guess that would be a big trait of a codependent, you know, or codependent type actions. And then we justify it, just like the alcoholic or addict justifies their behavior because of this or that, you know. And they're like, what? I'm just your mom, or yo, I'm just your dad, or oh, I'm just your son, or whatever. But a lot of it's still reaching and clinging and grasping for control, and that control that we crave is so we can be at peace and feel okay, and feel comfortable.
It builds a sense of guilt, like when you say when your parent gives you money
it makes you feel guilty or like you owe them something, or there's this perpetual feeling of guilt that carries on, and a sense that you've lost control, or that you don't quite have the ability to go and get that money on your own, or deal with the struggles. Like it makes you feel like you've lost your own sense of responsibility, in a
Yeah.
sense. And I think that can put you in a pit, in a sense too. So,
It denies you of growth, you
yeah.
know? It's like actually st because it's a fix. It's just like an alcohol or drug fix to me, or food fix, or these kind of things. It's a fix. It's a temporary fix. Without regard, or with less regard than it should be, to a better solution that's better for the long term. It's a temporary fix. You
I mean,
know,
not that
it's
you
like, oh,
shouldn't
let
be
me give you some
grateful,
money.
though, you know. I mean,
Oh,
not that you
yeah.
shouldn't be grateful for it, you know, if you do get it, if you do get help, or, you know, but
Sure.
it's not necessarily that, it's not like a net positive or net, like it could just, I mean, I think it could be looked at in many different ways. I just don't want to like totally say, oh, it's terrible to give your kids money,
No, it's
but it
absolutely
can
not. I
be
mean,
bad for sure.
there wouldn't be businesses without families
Yeah,
helping people
for sure.
out. There wouldn't be artists without, you know, and I struggle with that too, but there
Yeah.
wouldn't be without benefactors since the beginning of, you know, any type of commercial artistic music. You know, there's been someone who's helped somebody out. Somebody who had a different position in life who was able to help out someone who was struggling financially to allow that person to sort of work on their art or work on their, you know, whatever it was, or their business,
But it
or
can be
their, you know,
overdone.
or their spiritual journey. You know, like monks would, and nuns and people, you know, spiritual people in the spiritual community wouldn't be able to survive without the community. So it's back to that thing of like, to what extent, and is it helping, or it more, is it harming me more than it's helping me? And when I accept too much, like what comes with that? How do I feel about myself? Am I okay with that? You know, can I find balance here? Can I find a way to sort of be at peace with this, you know, as it is? You know, can I be okay with working in the factory, and can I be okay with getting help making music? You know, because that's what I sort of ultimately strive for, is this. I mean, strive is that maybe not the word, but I think it's maybe what I need is the balance of that acceptance of anything's okay, everything's okay. You know, that it's like that I'm that I can find a way to handle any situation. And I don't, because of the people that I know that only depend on, like, that I'm an artist and all I can do is make music for money. They end up in a lot of unhealthy relationships with
Situations.
themselves and with their music and with business and things. And they can, I want to be well-rounded, you know, in the sense of like, artistically, spiritually, emotionally, mentally, whatever, philosophically, like whatever it is, you know, I want to be open and sort of able to sort of go with the flow, and accept whatever comes, because life is just too short to try to control the river all the time, and to constantly be damming it up to make the water go where I want it to go. That's hard on the dam, you know, and it's just constant work to do that. It's just a lot easier just to go with it. And you know, I the most at peace I've been in my life is times where I'm like, yeah, I could do music or not, you know. And I know that I'll probably still, I haven't written in a while, and I've just been doing other things, you know. I've been doing things that are learning different instruments a little bit, and doing different aspects of music, and then doing some regular work. And I'm okay with that, you know, because I don't like having to ask all the time for sort of help. to be able to continue to be a music artist, and just always be striving for like the next step and the, you know, doing the next thing to make the next dollar at it, or stressful. To get out another record. It's very stressful, and I'm 52 years old. It gets a little, it's hard, and I'm by no means complaining, but I do much better when I just accept that I don't have to just do that. You know, that's a decision, you know, that's a decision to be an artist, and I can be an artist, and do good for the world and myself, whether I do material art, or if I'm just trying to be nice to people, or just talking to people, or listening to people, or just walking down the street and smiling at somebody. I mean, there's art in all of that. And ultimately, we are kind of talking about commercialism. I mean, not commercialism, but we're talking about commercial art, you know, like having a career. And we were talking about this morning as well. It's that if you look at what you do as a prayer or as a meditation while you're doing it, when you're working on, you know, then it sort of takes that whole thing of like being watched and performance and results based. It sort of takes it out of the picture, or it helps it push it away from the picture a little bit, in not the, you know, the focal point. And because if I'm playing and I'm doing this as a way of, whether it's therapeutic or whether it's meditative or like I said, a prayer or whatever, like when I'm playing or writing, then isn't it a little ridiculous to worry about what someone thinks about the way I pray, you know, and the way I meditate? And also it takes, like, if my elbow hurts, which I have some tendonitis, you know, like things like that. Well, if I was at a monastery, or if I was, you know, at a meditation practice, like I'm going to be uncomfortable doing that sometimes too. It's not about feeling good. Like, getting back to the fix thing, I'm not meditating so I can relax and feel good. You know, it's just not me, you know, I don't see that as the point. Meditation is to clear out the unreality of things, and to focus on the breath and focus on what really is going on in my body and my mind, and observe it, and get in the present and get rid of the sort of the fantasies of things and the stories and the narratives, whether it's the pain in my elbow while I'm playing or all these things. But it's also reality that I'm going to have those things. And so I just observe them. And I think that's why a lot of times I feel better after I play a show. If I'm not so worried about what people think, it's like, I a lot of times feel better because it's like a yoga practice, like a mind and body yoga practice, and meditative practice. And then so I like literally feel better because I've had a focus and because I've got into the reality of things and not into the narratives of my head and body and my judgment of those things. So.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, you said a lot there, and I think when you stop playing for money, or when you stop, say, I mean, I like to write, I'm a writer, and when I'm in a flow state, I'm not thinking about anything except for what I'm writing about, you know? And I think in a sense, when you're in a state like that, you're not like writing for money, you're not writing for people to read it, you're not even writing for you to read it. You're like, in a sense, you're writing to your soul, or you're writing to God, or you're writing to some kind of thing that's kind of beyond this material reality, in a sense. And I think it's a lot like what you said. It's a prayer. It's meditative when you're doing any kind of creative act. And I mean, would you rather write or play music for money, or would you rather write, play music for your soul, you know?
Yeah, I don't, you know, there are things I do, there are gigs that I take that I don't really, I'm like, yeah, it's, you know, I don't know if this will be that great, but I do need the money, you know? But that's I mean, maybe I'm like playing mental gymnastics and twisting things around, but to conform to my wants to survive, you know, yeah. in music or whatever. But that's a practice too. That's a practice, and that's a meditation or whatever, to be yeah. grateful, and that somebody yeah. wants me to do this. They're asking me to do it. That I'll do this and I'll accept the money for it. And yeah. I can turn anything. And I mean, that's all of life, is a practice of like testing yourself. And I could go, okay, this will be some bar gig that there's, you know, people won't pay attention much, or some whatever kind of gig that, yeah. that I don't necessarily think people are going to pay attention. And I might make okay money at it, and I need that money, and it allows me to do yeah. other things. And so that's like, you know, it's kind of growing up and being mature. Yep. And that's, yep, you know, exactly. and there's nothing wrong with that, because I chose to do that part of the profession. But I'm also yep. just as fine with getting a regular job,
yep,
and a day job, and just doing what I feel like at night. I was listening to there's a great, I was getting into this podcast called Rosin the Bow, and it's all about, fiddlers and violinists and cellists and stringed instrument players and bowed instruments and luthiers and bow makers and stuff. And it's a really great podcast, because a lot of it, he gets into like the philosophy of a lot of the stuff. Wow. And it's there's a world renowned fiddler, but he didn't really do it for a living. Like, he was really well known all around and really well respected. And he said, you know, early on, he decided that he was just, I think he was a professor. He was just going to be a professor and then play fiddle on the side, because that's what he loved. And he just wanted to keep it separate. And also, he realized he could actually play more than if he was a touring musician. Like, he could play 3 or 4 hours a night if he wanted to, but as a musician, he's like schlepping around hotels, doing yeah. interviews, doing all this stuff. And then he might get to play 1 hour a night. And then he has to, when he plays, he's playing in front of people, and it's always performative, and he's not experiencing and learning his craft and quite as much. And it becomes a different thing. And so that, you know, I was like, that's a choice, you know, that I can definitely see the benefits to that. And that's a little bit appealing to me as well, is to be like, you know, I don't have to do that gig, or I don't, I can sort of pick my, cherry pick gigs, or cherry pick, like when I want to make a record and not feel pressure. And part of that is pressure for myself, but that I have to sort of keep up with the Joneses and make a record every year or whatever. It's just like, yeah, just kind of do it when, you know, I mean, especially as a writer, you need life experience. You can't just have road experience and not have relationships with people and be able to do other things in your life. It's part of what you write about. You know, you have to be a human and experience things and not just be a touring musician. There's anything wrong with that. You know, at different times I've wanted to do that, and at different times I have done that. And there's things I like about it, and there's things that I'd rather be home. You know, times I'd rather just not do that. Takes its toll on you for sure.
Yeah, and that's a balance that you got to figure out, right? With any creative process, I think you do need. It's not like you could spend all your time creating if you're not consuming anything, you know, because. Your thoughts come from somewhere, and they certainly don't just come from you, right? You know, it's all kind mm-hmm. of a mixture of factors of things that you learn, read, experience. Mm-hmm. And you need those experiences to have good creations. So, I think there's definitely a balance between, like, wanting money, right? And, like, wanting to be able to pay your bills, and also mm-hmm. wanting to write or play music, right? And you can have both of those things at the same time.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, and they're all just choices, you know. It's like, okay, I'm going to take this path. I mean, maybe I'm just privileged that I get to make those choices, but I mean, at the same time, there's people out there who aren't, you know, wouldn't consider that great at what they do, and they make a living at lots of jobs, whether it's music or whatever. They just have the desire and they make it happen, you know. So there's tons of them out there. You know, a lot of people have more desire than they have sort of, I guess you would say, talent or experience and skills, you know, at whatever field they're in, but they just find a way, they just muscle through.
Yep.
And that's a skill unto itself as well. There's nothing wrong with that, you know. And some people do that and then they just acquire the experience along the way and they get better, you know. There's plenty of people like that.
And I was wondering, do you ever feel yourself getting overwhelmed with projects? Like, oh, I want to do this, I want to do that. I haven't been putting in enough time on this or that, and like, and then you like start to feel guilty about not putting in enough time on stuff.
I used to more in the past, but I, like I was saying earlier, I just kind of am more at peace with whatever. And I don't mean whatever in like a nihilistic way of like whatever, you know, but just being okay with multiple things and different options and going with the flow and just you know, if I write more, great. If I don't, great. If I do something else, great. Like, that's totally fine. And I know that I'm going to do my best to have a decent life and be okay with whatever comes, because we don't have any real control over whatever comes anyway. You know, anything can happen at any time. And I don't want to like use my, if today's my last day, I don't want to use it worrying about that stuff.
Yeah.
Stressing and striving and just being and feeling guilty and beating myself up over things. Most of it I have no control over. I don't have control over how many hours are in the day. You know, I don't have control over, you know, my body type a lot of times. Like, you know, like if some people just naturally built for playing certain instruments or they have a certain kind of voice, and, you know, it's just like, I've got to accept that I have a deep voice, you know, so to speak. You know, I got to accept that I'm not a true tenor. You know, I have to accept my limitations. And then when I accept them, I can work on expanding them, you know?
Yeah, no, I really like that idea. Like, when you accept your limitations, you can work on expanding them. And do you mean like expanding your limitations in like, or I guess expanding on what you could do outside of your limitations, or what do you mean?
Yeah, by that? I mean, I guess it's just the way you're looking at it. Like, you, like if I accept, like I'm gonna fail if I just think that, oh, I'm just gonna jump into being this kind of singer or this kind of player. Like, I have to accept like my limitations and accept what I think I'm good at or not, or take input from others, which, you know, a novel idea, but and have other people give me feedback like, oh, I see you as this or that, you know, and not be sort of in the prison of my own idea of myself. Just that I can sort of, when I see where, I guess it could be looked at in different ways. It could be looked at as my limitations, and you could also look at it as like the boundaries that I've put on things as well. And to go and to really look at it and go, is anything really holding me back, or am I making that up? You know?
Yeah. I think that's a really good point, because there's so many things where like, oh, I can't do that. And it's like, well, is that true? Or do I just want to not be able to do that? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Is that like, a matter of convenience, like a convenient narrative?
Yeah. Cause like, I'll say like, oh, like I'm really bad at catching things, you know, I'm not going to try any ball sports or anything like that. But I mean, part of the reason why I'm bad at it is because I don't even practice catching things, right? So.
Yeah. Yeah, because you've written that narrative already.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, oh, I'm not the type of person that can fill in the blank here, you know, or because of this, then whatever. And then so you're a victim of circumstance, and it's really just an attitude. It's really just your perception. You know, it's not really the case. You know, it's not really true. And that's sort of like philosophical. That's another thing, is to say, is this true? Is this really true? You know, and that's a meditation practice. You go, is that just a story? Yeah. Is that a narrative I'm writing here? Or is this true? Or is it something that I've been told all my life?
Yep.
You know, that, oh, people like you can't do this, or only people like you can do this.
Yeah, or you've been telling
And that's
yourself
just
that too your whole life.
absolutely, you know, and it's re like all that, it like goes back to like childhood. And I mean, we really, so much of our narratives are taught to us by our parents or the people around us in society and our friends group and our peers and our schools and you know, even back to when we're like 3 to 8 years old, it's there's so much is imprinted on us, and some of that, so much of that wiring happens then. And you know, and that is not an excuse, but that's from what I understand, that's very true. It doesn't mean it can't be worked on, but I have to accept that
Yep.
that this is where I am, and look at where I am. And with like a soft look, you know, like a soft gaze instead of like soft eyes, as they say, not like navel gazing or like really like picking it apart too much, just go, yeah, oh yeah, okay, you'd see
Yeah, just
that, yeah,
observe it.
maybe, but observe, I mean, a lot of times just accepting it and observing it and being aware of stuff is like enough to really set the ball rolling, you know, for change. Because you know, once you accept that that may be the case, it's sort of the cat's out of the bag. I don't know why people walk around putting cats in bags, but you know.
Yeah. I think there's even just one little, like, if you just see something slight in a slightly different way, that can totally change your life, like the way you see things. I mean, I used to have commitment issues, and I think I've mentioned this on the podcast, but then my girlfriend, she told me, well, I think part of the reason why you have commitment issues is because you're keeping that door of being able to leave open, right?
Yep.
And then I never once conceptualized it that way. Like it never even occurred to me like that. And then I thought, oh, well, I guess I just need to close the door, right?
Yeah.
And
Yeah. Or
I think
yeah,
there's
or
lots of
just
things like that.
and that's, yeah, people have a hard time making decisions because they have to make that, you know, that whole perfect being the enemy of good. And they need an escape route, or they like, I've heard people, especially people in recovery, talk about this kind of thing where it's just like, oh, I can't commit to like going to this party or going to this dinner or whatever. And they just can't, because they need to keep their options open. Because, you know, we could get into this, but you know, a lot of people would say that's
Go for it.
trauma response. You know, that's a trauma response, because you need to be able to read the room. You need to always be sort of in control of these things. So you can be okay. And so you, because you're in sort of a fight or flight mode, you know, in your life, so to speak, that you need to sort of make sure that you're, that you can change at any moment, because you have to change to like deal with the room, because your life depends on it. That's the trauma response, is like you're in danger, you know, and that's, there's something to that too,
Yeah,
you
it's
know,
like,
that a
well,
lot of this stuff.
especially with parties. I mean, there was this one time I was invited to my buddy's birthday party, and I thought, and I was like, yeah, sure, I'll come. And then I started thinking about it. And how, oh, I'm gonna get there's gonna be people there, they're gonna ask, you know, what if they ask me questions? But I just kept going through the things in my mind. I was like, you know, Kevin, I'm good, man. I'll hang back. I'm not coming to the party. But yeah, I've been in situations like that for sure. Where I've left the door open of, well, I could always not go, right? But at the end of the day, you know, none of those people care about my anxiety, or like they're not going to judge me while I'm there. You know, they don't care. They're worrying about themselves, you know.
Yeah, they're not. I mean, and that's the thing, is like, you know, go back to the sort of the codependent thing, or the controlling kind of thing. It's like, why are we all like trying to play God? You know, we're all trying to like be omnipotent, you know, we're also trying to be omniscient, like we're always trying to like know what's going on, and we have to keep the doors open, blah blah blah, so we can manipulate and move the chess pieces, you know,
Yeah, you
and
got
be
to
the
give up
actor and
control.
be the, yeah, be the actor, be the narrator, to be, you know, to be the writer, to be the lighting person. It's like, oh, because we just can't let that go. And it's there's a lot of issues with control with that stuff. It's like we have to sort of keep things tidy in a way that we need them to be tidy, and we're bad at it, you know. So we a lot of times just make it things worse by doing that. You know, so we commit to things that we shouldn't have committed to, and then we won't commit to things that we probably would have gotten a lot out of, because we've written these narratives ahead of time, because they create a story which we can make sense of, you know. And it's self-centeredness, and usually it's not that we're not at the center of the story ever, you know. We're almost always at the center of the story, and
yeah,
and we will do a lot of things to stay at the center of the story, unhealthy things that we don't even know we're doing. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, no, and I've experienced that. I mean, I think everyone's experienced that. They're probably throughout their whole lives, and I think it's something really hard to deal with just like trying to control every little situation. And you were saying that a lot of times when you do try to control situations, it makes it worse. And I agree. Like whenever like I feel like I'm in a situation where, oh, I need everything to be perfect, I need to be perfect, at some point it all kind of just crumbles, or like because I try to control this other thing went out of whack, and then, you know, one thing leads to another, and it all becomes like, oh, like I just made a bunch of mistakes over and over again because I was trying to control the situation too much, you know?
Yeah. It happens all the time. It's like I end up making things worse a lot of times. I try to keep things in line with the way and a lot of times I don't even realize I'm doing it, you know, to control a conversation or narrative or whatever, or a situation or person or place or a thing. I mean, it's just, and it's really futile because you can't change people. You can't change, like, and it's rare that we change it for good. You know, usually it backfires when we do. Like if we do have control over it, we have control over it in a negative way.
Yeah.
You know, things fall apart. We create, rather than letting things fall apart, we go nuclear.
Yeah, and it's kind of a, like you try to control a situation, and the universe is like, oh, sorry, but you're not supposed to have control over this. I'm going to make it a little bit worse for you just because you did that.
Yeah, I mean, we have such little control over things. It's really our own actions, you know, that we have much control over. We don't have control over our bodies a lot of times. At least the fact that, you know, like in Buddhism, it talks about the five remembrances, you know, that we don't, that we're basically destined to get sick. We're destined to get old. We're destined to die. Everybody that we know is going to change, and we're going to change, and we have no control over that, and it's inevitable. And then the fifth is just that we, you know, my actions are the ground for which I stand, you know, that's, and the consequences of those, you know, and that's a simplification, but that is true though. I mean, that's and then you could get it, you know, if you really want to wax, you could, you know, get into the whole philosophy of like self-will. Do we really have even that much control, or how much are we programmed? And that's a whole big argument, you know, in a discussion of like, you know, oh, well, that's just willpower. It's like, yeah, but how much control over my programming do I have? You know, I was built this way, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's kind of a multiple, you know, there's like an infinitely number of factors that come into play of the reasons why you do certain things, or the reason why you look the way you do. Cause there's so many, you know, infinitely many things at odds with each other. You know, there's there's like billions of atoms in your own body, you know, there's just so many factors that come into play with every decision that we make. And it's not like we can really say we have full control over ourselves. Obviously we need to take responsibility for our actions, but that doesn't mean that we're always at fault. And that's what my therapist told me about a year ago. He told me that instead of taking blame or saying that someone's at fault for something. I just need to recognize what I did or what happened and then take responsibility to change it, right? I don't know if you've had similar thoughts about that. I know that you were talking about like giving up control and then taking up responsibility. That's kind of why I started thinking about it earlier.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it is about like what, you know, like sort of being accountable for like your part in things, you know, and it's that thing of like to accept myself and others, to sort of to be accountable and then to be have some kind of grace, for lack of a better word, in holding others accountable. You know, I think there's this whole, you know, there's a sort of this movement. I won't call out any specific political affiliations, but I will say libertarian. No, I'm just kidding. But there is a there's sort of a sort of this thing about people using stoicism.
Yeah.
Or people in recovery. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed it. As sort of this badge that they want to put on everybody else.
Yeah.
Is the accountability. But Marcus Aurelius was not talking about holding everyone else accountable. It was holding himself accountable in his diaries.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, people shouldn't be doing that. It's this whole, like, we learn these things and then we try to hold everybody. They shouldn't act that way. Of like, oh, that's just not going to work. You know, it's like, I want to have some kind of grace with letting people be where they are, letting me be where I am, and holding myself accountable. Now, if somebody's crossed a boundary with me, then I need to speak say to something. That at some point. Yeah, if I need to, but not to run around and like screaming and taking everybody's inventory and telling, you know, having this looking down upon view because I've got a little recovery, or because I learned a little bit about stoicism, or I've learned a little bit about accountability or taking responsible and like pulling my bootstraps up and all this kind of stuff. And then forgetting that, you know, the practice is to like hold myself more accountable than I hold other people. Because I will never be fully accountable. So who am I to like try to hold other people accountable?
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, we're not like the judges of other people.
If I need to. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it gets turned around. You know, it's sort of like the person who quits smoking becomes the, you know, the fascist non-smoker and just as shitty to everybody because other people are still smoking. You know, and I think I see that in like, the people with a lot of this philosophy type stuff, you know, and I don't know if you've noticed it. I didn't mean to call it the libertarian thing. That's probably not the case, but I guess it's sort of like some of like the Rogan world and like some of that, like kind of thing, like that, you know, super macho kind of stuff. And it's just like, you know, oh, using Marcus Aurelius to be like, that's what a man does. And it's like, no, I don't think that was the point. You know,
well, I think that's, you know, you're like falling into dogma and religion and there's like some really hardcore like militant atheists out there who are always you believe that, like, you get all angry and everything, and just like with any sort of belief system, any philosophy, it can get, you know, people will get, you know, caught up in the swarm of it, you know, and act like bees.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's convenient as well, because what it does, it's another way of taking the responsibility off of us and putting it on other people.
Yeah.
You know, blame another country, blame another group of people, blame another specific person, blame a situation and not be accountable, you know? You know, I see it in all kinds of people that I know in different groups. I have friends who were like, oh, the capitalist system, you know, blah, 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 as they're walking out of Target, you know, and, or they're talking about the government, you know, or they're talking about another political party, and then they don't realize that, like, really, we're all buying into this. We're all creating this. We all have an effect on it. We all we're voting with our money, and we're like we're buying a bunch of stuff, you know. And you can call yourself a liberal or a conservative, but we all shop at the same stores for the most part. A lot of times.
Exactly.
And we're still buying too much material goods that are hurting the earth, and we're all buying into our addictive natures because we want to fix and we want to feel better. And we, you know, and we're all, it's even if sometimes it feigns that it's for the greater good, that it's better, you know, we want to feel better than that other side. What I think it's just a bunch of BS. Sorry, it was kind of a little bit political or apolitical or whatever you want to call it, but it's
it's
a little frustrating. Nobody wants to be accountable and realize that we have this, that we're creating this through what we buy and what we do and our choices, you know.
And by not talking to people, right, and by like isolating ourselves from others and not having tough conversations with people. And falling into whatever our whatever we're worshiping, whether it be a philosophy or a political ideology or an image, a body image, or whatever it is that we're in a sense addicted to, either ideologically or physically or financially.
Absolutely.
I did want to ask you before I went back to work, if how you got into music in the first place, like what's your story?
My family's really into music. Like, my dad was a church choir director, and my sisters all sing, or most of them. And so it was a kind of a musical family, but like my mom and a couple of my sisters played some piano. But I didn't grow up playing an instrument or anything. I got asked to be the singer in a punk rock band who was looking for a singer to replace the guitar player who was the singer at the time when I was 15. And I sort of fell right into it, started playing live shows when I was barely 15, right when I turned 15. And that's just crazy. Sort of hadn't really looked back, you know, so whatever, 35, 40 years, whatever that is. That was just, and then I was just a singer for like 3 years. And then I started playing guitar because I didn't want to just sing. And I wanted to sort of have my hand in writing the stuff. And I did that for a few years with that band. And then I left that band. We broke up and I formed another band, Six String Drag, my last band, that's been on and off for years now, since the 90s. But I've just sort of done it since I was very young, you know. I mean, not young like I took lessons at 5 and 10 years old, but young as far as like, you know, early high school on. I've always been in bands and played live and made records. So been doing well.
And you feel kind of like, I guess, why do you play music? Do you feel like it's something that you've just always done, or that you're drawn to it in a certain way more than others? Or
I don't know if I can answer that. Yeah, I don't know if I can. I think it's just, I mean, I'm not going to be so bold as to say, oh, it's just, it's me, it's who I am. I mean, I'll let other, but somebody else can say that. But I just do, you know. It's just, it's the way I think. I write in my head, you know. I don't like pick up instruments usually and start writing. I mean, every once in a while, but most of the time it's in my head. So it's just kind of, it's going in there all the time. Whether I'm working on something or I got somebody else's song in my head or whatever, it's just my process of sort of, it's part of my thinking, I think, for better or for worse. Just sort of, I'm sure, as like you write fiction, right, as well, you know, that you sort of have these stories and narratives going into your head, through your head, about characters, and it's just sort of part of your thinking, I would imagine.
Yeah, no, it is. You know, I'll start thinking about some world or, you know, some person with a power or some conflict or
Yeah. And which is what I'm doing.
whatever
I'm
it
sort of
is.
creating worlds in my little songs that are just sort of like the ones I create in my head, or these sort of narratives or these character developments. And they have me in them and they're in me. And
Yeah.
we just play around in there, in my
Yeah, it's kind of a
head.
part of us.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's I don't really know how other people think, I don't really ask like about what normal people think, like do you like I don't really even know how a non-songwriter would think because it's been so long since I was a non-songwriter. Even then I was like writing things down and like little ditties. I mean, I was told that when I was really young, I would write little songs and sing them like in the family van because I was the youngest of six kids and we'd be on road trips and I would just make up stuff. And I'd realize later, like when I got older, I'd remember that little tune I'd like wrote and I'd be, oh, that was based on so and so. Oh, that was on the radio that year. That's why I sort of ripped that off. So I've been stealing songs since the beginning. Still doing it.
Oh, well, thanks for coming on the podcast, Kenny.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. Well, everybody, that's Kenny Roby. Yeah. And you can find him on Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, basically anywhere that you get your music. He's got lots of really good songs. I would classify it as country. How would you classify your music?
I don't know. It's just I don't know. It's got so many different
Yeah.
facets and aspects to it that it's just kind of roots leaning music. I mean, it's somewhat traditional based, but I don't know if I'd say country, but I guess just songwriter music. Just
Cool. Awesome. Well, yeah, thanks again for coming on the podcast, and we'll catch you guys next time.